This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The primary campaign season should be showing off American democracy at its best. Yet for many Americans, the campaigns are demonstrating what's wrong with American politics. My guest William Grider offers a diagnosis of our ailing political system in his new book, Who Will Tell the People? The Betrayal of American Democracy, and in a Frontline documentary that will be broadcast tomorrow evening on public television. Grider says the roots of democratic decay are deeper than the political personalities and the parties they represent. The whole relationship between the citizens and the government that represents them has been deformed. Grider is a former assistant managing editor at the Washington Post who now writes about politics for Rolling Stone. His earlier book, Secrets of the Temple, was about the Federal Reserve. Grider is critical of both political parties. He calls the Democrats the party of Washington lawyers.
The Democrats, if you look at the Democratic National Committee and just ask the simple question, what is this organization, you find that there's nothing there. There are no people there. It's a hollow shell of what the Democratic Party used to be. I think one of the most startling facts in my book is that I ask them, well, who are your regulars? Who are the people who send in a little check pretty much every year? And that group is only 100,000 people. Think of that, 100,000 people in a nation of 180 million. And here's the real shocker. The average age of those Democratic regulars is 70 years old. So you have an atrophied organization that no longer connects to people. And then you ask, well, who does connect things within this party? And it turns out to be a very narrow cadre of influential lawyers and lobbyists, most of whom served in government at one time or another or served alongside presidential candidates. And they broker, in a sense, among the different fiefdoms of the Democratic Party in Washington. Most of them represent corporate clients on issues that are often directly counter to the interests of the party's own constituencies, and the conflicts with labor are the most obvious ones, but there are many, many others. And on many issues, they are hostile, sometimes quite openly, to the grassroots constituencies. I mean, if you listen to the voices of the Democratic Party establishment, the so-called wise men, they are constantly lamenting the fact that women, blacks, other minority groups have too much influence over the Democratic Party. And if you listen to their dialogue, you would believe that the Democratic Party is somehow steered by this coalition of malcontented, marginalized citizens. I mean, it's ludicrous. It has nothing to do with the real governing agenda.
Okay, so you call the Democrats the party of Washington lawyers. You call the Republicans the party of mass marketing.
Yeah. The Republicans, if you say that the only purpose of politics is to hold power, then the Republican Party has been an enormously successful political organization in recent years because it figured out how to hold power, namely the presidency, in the midst of alienation. And it does that by posing as the party of the disaffected. It says, we're with all of those people who feel like they've been cut out, who feel powerless, and we share their resentments against those dirty elites. Now, those happen to be liberal elites, but the posture is quite effective. And in different ways over the last 20 years, really, Republicans have perfected that posture. They're in a bit of a collision with it this year, I think, because after all, they have had the presidency now for 12 years, and it becomes increasingly hard to gull people into believing that the George Bush is an outsider. Nevertheless, he's going to try again this year.
I think yesterday Bush said something like people should vote for him because they want change.
Right. He's the candidate of change. Well, if people swallow that, then they deserve whatever they get, I would say. But I don't want to get partisan in this diagnosis because underneath that manipulation, and remember Republicans just by their nature are the party of business and commerce. They always have been. And so they have a familiarity with with this sort of big think mass market messages. It comes out of advertising and public relations, and I make the comparison in the book that if you look at the use of television by the Republican Party, its techniques and premises are really identical to the way commercial advertising operates on television.
Do you think that your critiques of the Democratic and Republican parties apply to each other? In other words, do you think that the Democrats are also the party of mass marketing and that the Republicans are also the party of lawyers and lobbyists?
Yeah, and I could have analyzed both parties in exactly the same terms, but it would have been redundant to do so. But in fact, that's a good point, Terry, that the Republican Party has the same hierarchy and the same disconnection from its constituencies. They have an elite which in many ways is much more removed than the Democratic elite operating in Washington. And likewise, the Democrats are trying, and each year they try again, to emulate the mass marketing manipulation that the Republican Party knows so well. There's one other important point to make about the Republicans. The Republicans have not governed in the last 12 years as a party of conservative ideology. What they have done is govern in behalf of conservative clients.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that, yes, they are for less government unless one of their important client groups wants the government to intervene. And in that case, they want more government. And there are a million examples of this. The one that's played out most spectacularly for the taxpayers is the financial crises. They want the marketplace to decide things until major Republican banks are in trouble. Then they want a program of sort of managed intervention in which the federal government props up those banks, changes the rules, put some money on the table, courtesy of the taxpayers, to recapitalize those banks and so forth and so on. So what I'm arguing is that this is a party that trots out a banner of laissez-faire, small government, and in fact governs quite differently in behalf of the needs of its clients.
Do you think that the Democratic and Republican party machinery have lost control of the candidates? And I'm thinking, like, in this election, you know, the Democratic National Party has had to step in and ask Jerry Brown to kind of tone it down a little on Bill Clinton. I don't think the Republican Party is very happy at having Pat Buchanan doing so well in the early primaries.
Yeah, but that's true. But as you might guess, my sympathies are with the insurgents. Who are the party bosses? Ron Brown, chairman of the Democratic Party, is a decent guy and all that, but he's a lobbyist for one of these big law firms I'm talking about. What Democratic voters is he connected to? Who does he represent? Who is he accountable to? And you can ask exactly the same kinds of questions about the so-called leaders in the Republican Party. I mean, every year, or every election year, there's this perennial lament that, well, these are unsatisfactory candidates and the people should have shut up and let the leaders pick them. Well, who are the leaders? I mean, one of the central points of my book is that both of those political organizations we call the major parties have lost their connections to real constituencies of voters.
So many people are disenchanted with the choices in the primaries. So what do you think has determined which candidates have emerged as the leading candidates, especially in the Democratic Party, where it's been something of a free-for-all?
Well, the overly simple answer is money and media.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at 1984, 1988, and 1992, you see the same pattern. The candidate who prevailed was the one who raised the biggest bucks first. Bill Clinton did that, and Bill Clinton, I don't want to disparage him, he has his own assets as a politician and a candidate and so forth, but the fact is he went to this same infrastructure of lawyers, lobbyists, special interests, Washington establishment, and persuaded them over a number of years that he was a safe, reliable Democratic candidate for president, and they gave him lots of money. He then began early to impress the big media, mainly based in Washington, with his seriousness and reliability as a candidate. And so last January, long before any of us had really focused on any of these people, and the general public barely knew that that the season had begun, if you looked at the media, they would say Bill Clinton is the putative front runner. He looks like the best candidate, and there was a lot of ink spilled on what a wonderful candidate Bill Clinton was. One of the reasons the media was convinced of that is because Bill Clinton had raised more money than anybody else, and somehow that made him more responsible or real than, say, Tom Harkin of Iowa or Bob Kerry or whoever. So you see what I mean? You've started a destructive process in which other possibilities get closed out before the game is started. Now, in the end, that process ends up damaging Clinton himself, because the race is settled within a couple of months, and the media has nothing left to do except pummel Clinton some more, and that's what we've seen.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is journalist William Grider, author of the new book, Who Will Tell the People? The Betrayal of American Democracy. And that betrayal of American democracy is also the subject of a Frontline documentary that he produced that will be shown Wednesday evening on public television. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist William Grider is my guest. Getting back to the subject of, how the betrayal of American democracy goes beyond what we're seeing in the primaries and in the election process. You say what we've become is a mock democracy, that in a way we have all the trappings of free and open political discourse, but the system is guided at a deep level by powerful interests. Let me get you to elaborate on that.
Well, I mean, mock democracy has all the trappings of free and open debate. The problem is that it is defined by who has the resources, that is money, to play at that level. And if you enter the debate on almost any subject in Washington, it is circumscribed by experts of various kinds, most of whom have been put in the field by powerful interests. Now, it is true there are some experts speaking in for so-called public interest groups or environmental groups and so on. But the landscape of our contemporary political debate in Washington is overwhelmingly populated by the representatives, whether they're lawyers, lobbyists, think tank policy analysts, economists, scientists, on and on and on, who have been put there by corporate interests, trade associations, and others whose organized money is at play in politics.
Well, you're criticizing the think tanks in part for defining the debate. What's wrong with think tanks? I mean, they're scholars from top universities and people who are formerly affiliated with top universities at these think tanks who have the time to carefully research and analyze complex problems. Isn't that an asset for democracy?
Well, I would say, of course, the more I believe in the multitude of voices, and the more the merrier. But I think when you see, for instance, somebody quoted from AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, or CISS, what is that, the Center for International Strategic Studies, or the Heritage Foundation, as they're quoted ad nauseum in newspaper accounts of policy issues, and they appear on television all the time, instead of identifying them as an academic policy analyst, I would like to see this sort of ID run, brought to you courtesy of IBM, General Electric, General Motors, Ford, Chase Manhattan Bank, Citicorp, AT&T, and so forth, because that's why they're in the debate. These are not disinterested policy analysts. They've been hired by these tax-exempt think tanks to be present in the policy debate and to churn out various expert studies.
In your analysis of the press, you say that relations have become too cozy between the press and the politicians, and you give examples of reporters who play tennis with people in the cabinet and reporters who are married to people on the fringes of government and so on. But it's ironic if you think it's a time when the press is becoming particularly cozy with politicians, it's also a time that the press is going after politicians in a way that it never has before. So how do you explain that contradiction?
Well, what are they going after? They're going after Bill Clinton, who is not in power, and Jerry Brown, who is not only not in power, but they're quite sure won't be in power. And they may be going after George Bush on some personal questions. What they are not doing in any consistent, coherent way is challenging the assertions of those in authority on the real issues of government. And I will give you the most spectacular example, but there are scores of others. In 1988, when every insider in Washington knew, and I know this because I was talking to him at the time, that right after the election there was going to be a huge taxpayer bailout of the savings and loan industry. This was not a well-kept secret, believe me. And yet it never got – it not only didn't get communicated to the public at large, but it never was brought up as a challenge to either George Bush or Michael Dukakis during the campaign. That's a huge failure of the press.
What do you think the reason is?
And now they're doing it again this year
with
the crisis in commercial banking.
Mm-hmm.
And the facts are a little more complicated, but I've talked to these same people. They're lobbyists and they're people in Congress. Again, it doesn't take a super sleuth investigative reporter to figure out that right after this election, the American taxpayers are going to be told sometime next year that, well, it seems that you're going to have to pay for the commercial bank bailout as well because the banks can't pay for it. I mean, I've seen the memos. They're already written of how that issue will be dealt with. And it just won't be brought up in the election year.
I know that you're critical of the press for focusing on character issues at the expense of larger political issues. But this is the second election in a row where we've heard rumors that there is a story that could break about George Bush having had an affair. And I wonder if you have any insights into who's doing what behind the scenes to try to get that story and if you think there is a story.
Terry, I know the same rumors and gossip that all other insiders in Washington know and have heard it for years. And I cannot attest that they are true or false. I also believe, at least my impression is, that a number of news organizations have spent some energy, maybe a lot of energy, over the last, certainly in 1988 and before, trying to establish whether indeed George Bush had a mistress. And I don't want to trot through the bloody details of the rumors because I think that's unfair to George Bush and to the woman involved. It's fairly depressing, though, if you step back and think about it, that we are now going to judge fairness in media attention in this election year to whether they stick the president with the same adulterous charge that his opponent has been labeled. I mean, I'm sorry. I think that's going further downhill, even though I'm for fairness, too.
I know one of the things that irritates you is to see celebrities endorsing causes and becoming spokespeople for causes. I think that's the larger irritant.
Well, irritates the wrong word.
Okay.
I mean, that's become a major venue of politics, and I don't disparage those celebrities. I somewhere in the book I make the point that if you wanted a real critique of the Reagan era, it didn't come from the Democratic Party or from the media. It came from Hollywood and the celebrity entertainers who I think with some courage stood up and said, we think making war against Nicaragua is wrong, or we think homelessness is wrong, and so forth. You know, I mean, I don't knock those people. I admire them. The problem, however, is that celebrities, even the ones I admire, still leave the voters in a kind of passive audience role. And that's why my complaint really is that celebrity politics can only go so far in a very limited way in mobilizing people for that reason.
Do you know what your frontline documentary is up against on TV tomorrow?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
We're not going to mention it, though, right, Terry?
Well, no, actually, we are. The program is called What About Me? I'm Only Three. And the listing reads, Hollywood is banding together for a special look at our environment and our children. Celebrities offer information on the environment in response to questions from children. Celebrities include Lonnie Anderson, John Ritter, and host Anne Margaret.
Ah, but see, I thought you were going to mention Who Shot JFK, which is on some...
I wasn't even thinking about that one.
It's on some other channel, and it's bringing basically bringing in the body parts from the presidential murder. I mean, all we want to talk about is how government really, really does things to people, but that may be too esoteric against JFK.
As someone who is disenchanted with party politics the way it is today, are you going to vote?
Yeah, I always vote. Sure. Look, everything makes a difference. Don't fall for the cynicism of nothing makes a difference. It will be different if Jerry Brown is in the White House next January instead of George Bush. It will be different if Bill Clinton is in the White House. And yes, it'll be somewhat different if Senator X is gone and Mrs. Jones has replaced him. You know what I mean? I mean, the problem with the present is... people have to be able to imagine beyond the present. They have to be able to imagine about what they might make possible by their own action. A vote today is disconnected. Elections do not deliver accountability. That is all true. But the answer is not to retreat to the couch. The answer is to begin building from quite modest origins in lots of different places the kinds of political relationships that will restore those things. And you can't do that by withdrawing from electoral politics.
Well, William Grider, I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks.
William Grider is author of the new book, Who Will Tell the People? The Betrayal of American Democracy. And it's also the subject of his Frontline documentary, which will be shown Wednesday evening on public television. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.